Well, let me invite you to find your way back to your seats at this time. And if you have a Bible, there are some Bibles scattered about in the pews here, and it'll also be on the screen here. But if you have a Bible, I encourage you to open in your Bible to the Old Testament book of Habakkuk, which we began looking at last week. We will be looking at the remainder of chapter 1 this morning, so Habakkuk chapter 1, verses 5 through 17. Let's prepare our minds and hearts for the reading and preaching of God's holy word. Habakkuk chapter 1, verses 5 through 17. Look at the nations and watch, and be utterly amazed. For I'm going to do something in your days that you would not believe, even if you were told. I am raising up the Babylonians, that ruthless and impetuous people, who sweep across the whole earth to seize dwellings not their own. They are a feared and dreaded people. They are a law to themselves and promote their own honor. Their horses are swifter than leopards, fiercer than wolves at dusk. Their cavalry gallops headlong. Their horsemen come from afar. They fly like an eagle swooping to devour. They all come intent on violence. Their hordes advance like a desert wind and gather prisoners like sand. They mock kings and scoff at rulers. They laugh at all fortified cities they built by building earthen ramps. They capture them. Then they sweep past like the wind and go on, guilty people whose own strength is their God. Lord, are you not from everlasting? My God, my Holy One, you will never die. You, Lord, have appointed them to execute judgment. You, my rock, have ordained them to punish. Your eyes are too pure to look on evil. You cannot tolerate wrongdoing. Why then do you tolerate the treacherous? Why are you silent while the wicked swallow up those more righteous than themselves? You have made people like the fish in the sea, like the sea creatures that have no ruler. The wicked foe pulls all of them up with hooks. He catches them in his net. He gathers them up in his dragnet, and so he rejoices and is glad. Therefore, he sacrifices to his net and burns incense to his dragnet. For by his net, he lives in luxury and enjoys the choicest food. Is he to keep on emptying his net, destroying nations without mercy? This is the word of God. Your word, O God, is a lamp for our feet and a light on our path. Did you ever get an answer to a question that you didn't expect, and not just didn't expect, but would never have expected, and not just would never have expected, but an answer that you did not and would not even want to hear, such that the answer to your questions just prompts more questions? I'm sure you've had an experience like that. Or what about an answer to prayer? We tend to sort of think we know how God will or should answer our prayers, but what if we get an answer to our prayer that is so unexpected and even unwanted that it only prompts more prayers, more desperate prayers in response to the answer to our original prayer? That's a little bit about like what's happening here with Habakkuk, and let me just sort of create an imaginary scenario, I hope imaginary scenario here, that brings it a little, you know, helps us in our day step a little bit into Habakkuk's shoes situation here. Say, not an exact parallel here, say you're feeling troubled over the state of your country, and you're praying for your country, a good thing to do, right? You're praying that God would establish his righteousness in your country, that God would pay attention. It feels like he's not paying attention to all the evil and injustice around, and you pray and plead with him, God, pay attention to all the evil and injustice around and do something about it. And your faith is maybe a little perplexed as to why it seems like God isn't even listening, isn't even answering your prayers, isn't caring about your prayers. But then you get an answer. You get an answer. God says, hey, I got that. I'm on top of that. I've already got something underway, something I'm working up here. I'm going to deal with that and answer your prayer by having North Korea invade and conquer and enslave your country and exile many of you out of your country to live in strange foreign lands. I'm not trying to say whether that could or should or would happen, but I'm guessing that that would be, for anybody praying that prayer, that would be a most unexpected and unwelcome answer that would cause your faith to be more perplexed and bewildered and not less. And now we're getting a little bit closer to understanding Habakkuk's situation. So remember, if you weren't here last week, we're kind of jumping back in here, but I'll quick bring us up to speed. He feels troubled about his country. And it's not an exact parallel to what his country was at the same time in his old covenant context, also God's own covenant people. That's not the case in the new covenant. But anyway, he's praying that God would pay attention to all the evil and injustice around him, that God would do something about it, that God would establish his righteousness on the earth. And he's perplexed. His faith is troubled and bewildered as to why God isn't doing anything, as to why it just seems like God doesn't care, isn't paying attention. And after struggling and praying for presumably a while, since he's praying, how long, O Lord? He finally gets an answer. And God says, oh, don't worry, I'm on top of that. I'm working on something. I got it all underway. I'm going to judge your people, my covenant people, through the invasion, defeat, destruction, enslavement, and exile at the hands of Babylon. As much as in my imaginary scenario or more, it's not the way Habakkuk expected or wanted God to answer his prayer. And so the result is, after he brought this first prayer/complaint to God, the result is, after that is answered, he brings a second prayer/complaint that displays an even more deeply perplexed faith than where he started. And so the flow of thought here, the three things that we see in chapter 1, we looked at last week. Habakkuk brought a perplexed faith to God. That's verses 2 through 4. Then we're going to look at two things. First, in verses 5 through 11, Habakkuk receives a perplexing answer from God. And then third, in verses 12 through 17, Habakkuk has an even more perplexed faith. So we saw his perplexed faith last week, and now we see God's perplexing answer to his perplexed prayer of faith. Habakkuk's complaint prayer was essentially, God, why aren't you doing anything about all the evil and injustice around me in this community, in your covenant community? And in these verses now, in God's response to that, we see a few things. First, God doesn't rebuke Habakkuk. I'm going to mispronounce it and say it differently every time. God doesn't rebuke Habakkuk for bringing a complaint to him. That's kind of an amazing thing. He doesn't rebuke him for bringing the complaint. And God doesn't disagree with the complaint, at least as far as the assessment of the injustice that needs to be dealt with around him. Certainly it's not true that God isn't paying attention to it, but he doesn't disagree with the nature of the complaint in that he doesn't say, oh no, Habakkuk, you've got it all wrong. Things aren't really as bad as you think. He doesn't disagree. In fact, his response is an implicit agreement with Habakkuk's complaint that this nation is ripe for judgment because of their wickedness and injustice and evil. But verse 5, he warns that the answer to this prayer is not one that he or anyone will expect or want to hear. And he brings an utterly unexpected, bewildering, horrifying, in fact, answer. Verse 5, look at the nations and watch and be utterly amazed. For I am going to do something in your day that you would not believe, even if it were told. I am raising up the Babylonians, that ruthless and impetuous people. See, God had already begun answering Habakkuk's prayer. He already had a plan in place and unfolding in response to it, but it was not what he would expect. One writer says this, that when the Lord acts, he marks what he does as his own by not conforming to human expectations of what should happen next. And certainly, this response does not conform to human expectations. We're warned that it's utterly amazing, unbelievable. What is the unexpected, unbelievable nature of what God's going to do? It may be, it's probably some combination of these things. It may be that it is unforeseeable, as in no one would predict this. And in fact, you know, Babylon's rise to power and subsequent expansion of power and eventual fall from power, all those things happen relatively rapidly and quickly. And at this point, probably, Habakkuk is living through the transition of Assyria being the world-dominating power to Babylon being the world-dominating power. And Babylon had sort of started its movement towards power, but was not yet the dominant force. And so it may be that it's just an unpredictable kind of change of world empires and powers. It may refer to the unwillingness to believe it among Habakkuk's contemporaries. And this is what we see. It's a message of judgment, of harsh, severe, intense judgment, a message that is perennially unpopular. And in fact, among Habakkuk's contemporaries, there was a refusal to believe and receive God's warnings of judgments through the prophets, though they came again and again. You see this as a frequent theme in Jeremiah, who prophesied through a similar period as Habakkuk, that there were many false prophets in Jeremiah's day who prophesied peace, peace, when there is no peace. Jeremiah 5:12, it says this of the false prophets, they have lied about the Lord. They have said, he will do nothing. No harm will come to us. We will never see sword or famine. Those prophets are but wind, and the word is not in them. There was an unwillingness to believe what God said would happen. But also, this amazement and might refer to might mean just simply astounding, as in bewildering and horrifying. And this comes not only in the announcement that God would bring judgment on his people for their sins, but more so in the specifically identified instrument of that judgment, Babylon, that is a ruthless and impetuous people, and particularly that God's instrument of judgment to bring God's judgment on his people was a godless nation who were far more wicked than the people they were bringing judgment upon. And that becomes the essence of Habakkuk's second complaint, which we'll get to. God identifies Babylon, and this is an unbelievable, astounding, unexpected, thing that people did not expect or would not want to hear. And then God, after identifying the instrument of judgment, he goes on to characterize the instrument of that judgment, Babylon's actions and attitudes that characterize them and that would characterize the shape of the judgment they would bring upon God's people. And what we see is that though Babylon is God's instrument of judgment, they are an unwitting and unrighteous instrument of that judgment. That though God, acting righteously according to his divine plan to bring his righteous judgment through Babylon for his glory, nevertheless, Babylon is acting unrighteously according to human schemes to bring about their own glory. They are an unwitting and unrighteous instrument. And God's people, we saw last week, they've been violent and oppressive. And now, as judgment for that, God is bringing Babylon to be violent and oppressive to them. They are a fitting judgment for their sins. And these verses, verses 5, 6 through 11, describe two main characteristics. We're not going to go through line by line, but we're going to summarize that description with two main characteristics of Babylon: aggression and arrogance. Or to put it another way, sinful use of power and sinful pride. Sinful use of power and sinful pride. That first, sinful use of power, is summed up in the final words of God's characterization of them, whose own strength is their God. Whose own strength is their God. We talked about this in the Revelation study. I'm going to say it again. Don't worship power. God's people do not worship power, human strength. They worship God. Babylon worships human strength, political power, military might. Their own strength is their God. They worship human power and strength, and worshiping human power and strength, they seek it at all costs and use it in whatever way they will to accomplish whatever end they desire. They believe, essentially, that might makes right, that their strength over others justifies whatever brutal action towards others suits their purposes. And in particular, what is pictured is unprovoked aggression and assault upon others. I said we're not going to go through line by line, but I do just want to read this description again for us. God is raising up the Babylonians, that ruthless and impetuous people who sweep across the whole earth to seize dwellings not their own. They are a feared and dreaded people. They are a law to themselves and promote their own honor. Their horses are swifter than leopards, fiercer than wolves at dusk. Their cavalry gallops headlong. Their horsemen come from afar. They fly like an eagle swooping to devour. They all come intent on violence. Their hordes advance like a desert wind and gather prisoners like sand. They mock at kings and scoff at rulers. They laugh at all fortified cities. By building earthen ramps, they capture them. Then they sweep past like the wind. And go on, guilty people whose own strength is their God. This describes sinful use of power and aggression. Verse 6, seizing dwellings not their own. Verse 9, they fly like an eagle swooping to devour. What this is describing is not some kind of just war which opposes injustice or self-defense from an aggressor, but it describes being an unprovoked aggressor that is simply invading and terrorizing and destroying and killing and taking without just cause. There's no rules of warfare here. There's no respect for human life here. But they are simply, one writer sums it up there, eager for power, resolved on conquest, and insensitive as to how they achieve it. Might makes right. Sinful use of power. And the second characteristic is sinful pride. Verse 7, they are a law to themselves and promote their own honor. They promote their own honor. They are self-seeking, seeking not God's honor, not to exalt God's glory, not to make his name great or build his eternal kingdom. They seek their own honor. They seek to exalt and glorify themselves, to make their name great, to build their kingdom, which did not, will not last. And they promote their own honor, and they are a law to themselves. They live as though there is no higher standard or rule over them. But they are a law to themselves. They don't look beyond themselves, the self, for a standard of truth or for a criteria of what is right and what is wrong. But they do what is right in their own eyes. Not God's eyes, their own eyes. They act as though they are answerable to none, accountable to none. How many powers in this world have lived as such and have perpetuated such evil and injustice and human suffering as a result? This attitude enables, causes so much evil in the world, but of course, it's a delusion. It's a delusion to believe I'm answerable to none and accountable to none. They, Babylon, all of us, every human authority, every human power, every human person, no matter how great or small, strong or weak, will one day answer to God. And those whose own strength is their God, what will they stand on in that day when their strength fails? Babylon is God's instrument of judgment, but they are an unwitting and unrighteous instrument. And as though God is acting righteously according to his divine plan to bring his righteous judgment through Babylon for his glory, nevertheless, Babylon is acting unrighteously according to human schemes to bring about their own glory. And I just want to unpack that a little bit more here, because we see this in that some of the same images used to describe Babylon's wickedness are also used to depict God's just judgment on his people. So we, you know, two images in particular that are used early in Scripture to convey God's blessing to his people are now flipped upside down and convey God's anti-blessing, his judgment to his people. So verse 6, when we read that Babylon would seize dwellings not their own, this is certainly a description of Babylon's sinful, sinful use of power, conquests. But it's also reminiscent of the description of the conquest of the Promised Land, which was a unique situation in redemptive history where God expressly sanctioned his people to do this. But God promised his people that in taking the land, they would find dwellings not their own. Similar language. They would find flourishing cities they did not build, houses filled with good things they did not provide, wells they did not dig, vineyards and olive groves they did not plant. And their taking possession of the land by God's blessing involved their dispossessing of the Canaanites. The Canaanites who were receiving God's judgment because their sin had reached its full measure. Now is the reversal of that, the anti-blessing of that. Now God's people are put in the shoes of where the Canaanites were. And now because their sin had reached its full measure, God's judgment was coming upon them, and they were being dispossessed of the land. Anti-blessing, God's judgment. The second image is Babylon is described as gathering prisoners like sand. And again, this is a description of Babylon's sinful use of power and oppression in its conquest and oppression of people, that they're just gathering up endless captives and prisoners and slaves and exiles. But it's also reminiscent of God's promise of blessing to Abraham to make Abraham's descendants as numerous as the sand on the seashore. But now, instead of being a sign of God's blessing, of fruitfulness in establishing and gathering together this people, now it's anti-blessing. It's God's just judgment upon them for their sin. Now they're being, instead of being gathered like sand on the seashore, they're being dispersed and blown away like sand blown away in the wind. It represents them being scattered into exile as God's just judgment upon them for their sin. So Habakkuk receives a perplexing answer, verse 5 through 11. And then the next verses, 12 through 21, Habakkuk responds with an even more perplexed faith. The answer to his prayer raises more questions and problems and prompts more desperate prayers. It brings about a more perplexed faith. Isn't that an interesting reality there? Let's just pause and reflect on that, in terms of the result of Habakkuk's prayers being answered. As I said, he's probably presumably been praying for some time. How long, O Lord? He's been praying for some time, and certainly unanswered prayer is perplexing, right? And all that time, he's been praying, how long, O Lord, why aren't you answering me? That's a perplexing thing to faith. Unanswered prayer is perplexing. Answered prayer can be even more perplexing. Answered prayer can be even more perplexing because sometimes, like Habakkuk, God does not answer our prayers, as we talked about already, in the way we expect or want. You know, always God doesn't owe us an explanation for why he does things the way he does. And sometimes, like Habakkuk, our faith finds greater challenge, even if it's granted fuller insight into the ways of God. Sometimes our faith finds greater challenge, even as it's granted fuller insight into the ways of God. We tend to think the opposite, that, you know, the more revelation we receive about God, the less challenge of faith we will have. And sometimes that's true, but not always. Because as we are granted fuller insight into the ways of God, we dive deeper into the mystery and incomprehensibility of who God is. Not that he's unknowable, but that he is so big and so beyond our comprehension. As Isaiah 55 puts it, God says, my thoughts are not your thoughts, neither are your ways my ways. As the heavens are higher than the earth, so are my ways higher than your ways, and my thoughts than your thoughts. Such that the more we come to know of him, the more we come to realize how much of him we don't know. The more we understand of him, the more we realize how much we still lack understanding of him. One writer asked, can a small bottle contain an entire ocean? Can a small bottle contain an entire ocean? We are that small bottle. And the more we seek God and the more we know of God, the more we come very aware of how small a bottle we are and how vast an ocean he is. And so we worship him in humility and in awe. But before Habakkuk gets to his complaint and perplexity, he focuses on what he knows to be true about God. And we talked about this a little bit last week. Verse 12 and 13. Lord, are you not from everlasting? My God, my Holy One, you will never die. You, Lord, have appointed them to execute judgment. You, my rock, have ordained them to punish. Your eyes are too pure to look on evil. You cannot tolerate wrongdoing. He knows certain things by faith to be true about God, and he holds on to those things. He recites those things. He reminds himself of those things. One writer says, he lets what he is certain about shed light on what he cannot comprehend, rather than letting the difficulties obscure and unsettle what is true. That's a good way to approach the perplexities of faith, that even in his bewilderment, he holds on to what he knows to be true about God. He affirms God's character and his faith in God. And in these verses, he confesses that God is eternal, that God is holy, that God is immortal, and that God is sovereign. He will never change, and so his word will never fail. His promises are true and sure, and so his eternal purposes are as eternal and unchanging as he himself is. And Habakkuk recognizes that God is right to judge and discipline his people. You know, just like God didn't disagree with Habakkuk's assessment of their wickedness, Habakkuk doesn't disagree with God's intention to judge his people. He recognizes, he mentions God executing judgment and God punishing, which also can mean discipline or reprove. And this idea of discipline reflects God's commitment to his people, even when that commitment involves harsh discipline for their ultimate spiritual good. But the substance of his second complaint then arises in verse 13. Your eyes are too pure to look on evil. You cannot tolerate wrongdoing. Why then do you tolerate the treacherous? Why are you silent while the wicked swallow up those more righteous than themselves? And that's really the key idea of the complaint here. How can God use Babylon to judge his people when Babylon is more wicked than the people that they're bringing the judgment upon? How can God allow the wicked to swallow up in judgment those more righteous than they are? That's the essence of his complaint. And Habakkuk then in these verses goes on to describe Babylon's cruelty and sinful use of power and sinful pride in similar ideas as what he's already been described. It may be that some time has passed now between first answer and second complaint, and that it may be that Habakkuk or that Babylon has arrived on the scene and shown some of their cruelty and aggression, and Habakkuk's seen some of that. Much of this similar description, they treat image bearers like fish in the sea, verse 14, fish who are helpless to defend themselves. We read, the wicked foe pulls all of them up with hooks. This might reflect the Assyrian practice, which might have been adopted by Babylon, of leading captives away with hooks through their noses or lips. Verse 16, they worship their weapons of warfare. They enjoy their ill-gotten gain from their oppressive conquests. They are merciless. Verse 17, they have an unquenching appetite for more and more conquest. Is he to keep on emptying his net, destroying nations without mercy? It's like this relentless picture of mercilessness, this like this fisherman gathering up all these helpless fish in a net, dumping them out, and just doing it again and again and again. Is he going to keep on emptying his net, destroying nations without mercy? The substance is, why are you silent while the wicked swallow up more righteous than themselves? Well, we'll have to wait till next week for the answer. That comes in chapter 2. But before we leave, I want us to contemplate two points of application. First, God's sovereignty. And second, God's grace. God's sovereignty. Even though Habakkuk has serious questions and issues with God using the Babylonians, it raises kind of a problem of evil question for him. He doesn't resolve his concern by doubting or compromising his belief and conviction in God's sovereignty. The biblical authors never do. We read, you, Lord, have appointed them to execute judgment. You, my rock, have ordained them to punish. He recognizes God is sovereign over even this foreign pagan nation. He's sovereign over everything. He's sovereign over the whole international scene, the rising and falling of nations. That being sovereign is what makes God, God, to be maker of all, sourcer of all, in power over all, unrivaled and unmatched in power, absolutely sovereign over all things. And God rules over all nations. He controls all events. He causes nations to rise and fall. All of history is under God's control, following his divine plan, according to his divine timetable, through which he's working out his eternal purposes. He is, in fact, Ephesians 1:11, working out all things in conformity with the purpose of his will. This is not only true in the broad sweep of history and international events, it's true in the smallest details of the lives of individuals. The same God who makes nations rise and fall also numbers each hair on your head. God's sovereignty and God's grace. Habakkuk's puzzlement, as I said, is essentially, how can the favored of God be judged by the wicked? How can a unrighteous but less righteous nation be judged by a way more unrighteous nation? How can the wicked swallow up those more righteous than themselves? And I want us to think about that question as we transition to our celebration of the sacrament of the Lord's Supper. How can the wicked swallow up those more righteous than themselves? Because there was a time when it could be truly said, not just that the wicked swallowed up those more righteous than themselves, but when the wicked swallowed up the true, perfect righteous one, the eternally and infinitely favored of God. On the cross was when the one truly righteous one who lived a perfect life in every way and was without sin suffered at the hands of the wicked, of those whom he was infinitely more righteous than. Not just relatively more righteous than, not just a little bit more righteous than, infinitely more righteous than. He suffered at the hands of the wicked. The wicked swallowed up in death the Son of God. But of course, death could not hold him. And he rose and lives now in victory, having accomplished salvation for sinners. And here's the thing that I want us to think about. God brought about his most glorious work of redemption and salvation through this grossest and most evil of injustices on the cross. And when we look at the cross, that's what we see. And it gives us a confidence in the goodness of God, even in the bewildering times in our lives and faith. Because if God could bring such great redemptive good through this greatest act of evil and injustice, then isn't it possible that God can work his good redemptive purposes in our lives through any lesser evil or injustice or suffering that you or I face? And that's what we remember as we look, come to this table, and partake of this supper. It is a solemn ceremony, because it is a remembrance of the sacrifice of Christ in laying down his life for us, in him allowing himself to be, as it were, defeated by wicked men, in order to accomplish this greatest of divine victories and salvation. It's a solemn ceremony in which we remember and commemorate his death and sacrifice on our behalf. But it's also, the Westminster Confession of Faith also teaches us that it is for our spiritual nourishment and strength as we come to this table and receive not a normal meal, right? This isn't a normal meal, like a meal that we eat to get full or to give our body energy. It's not a meal. In fact, part of it occurred partially during a meal and partially after a meal. It was a ceremony added to an already existing meal. And the purpose of it wasn't to get full. The purpose of it was a ceremony that had a spiritual purpose. Unlike a normal meal that we eat physical food to get physical nourishment, it is symbolic of it is a spiritual meal in which we eat by faith to receive spiritual nourishment and strength from Jesus, our Savior, to enable us more and more to live by faith and in obedience to Him, even through the challenges that living by faith in this world brings.